When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to a special edition of New Books Network, in which we talk about previous winners of the Kuhlman Prize. I am Bernardo Batlazo, your host for today. Named in the honor of British business historian Donald Coleman, 1920-1995, this prize is awarded annually by the Association of Business Historians to recognize excellence in new research in Britain. It is open to PhD dissertation in business history, properly defined, either having a British subject or completed at a British university. All dissertations completed in the previous year to that of the prize are eligible. Today, we have Lewis Wade, a recipient of the Coleman Prize in 2023, with his dissertation entitled Privilege at a Premium, Insurance, Maritime Law, and Political Economy in the Early Modern France, 1664 to 1710, by the University of Exeter. Lewis, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Your dissertation, Lewis, has been published as advertised in the podcast under the title Privilege, Economy and State in the Old Regime, France, Maritime Insurance, War and the Atlantic Empire under Louis XIV, published by the Business Press in 2023, both as a paperback as an open access book. The link to this open access book will be provided in the show notes. Lewis Wade is a Marie Zlodowska-Curie postdoctoral fellow at Leiden University. His doctoral thesis was the recipient of the British Commission for Maritime History's Boydell and Brewer's Prize for the best doctoral thesis in maritime history. And as we've mentioned, by the Association of Business Historians, Coleman Prize for the best doctoral thesis in business history. So it is a real pleasure to have you today in the podcast, Lewis.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became an academic and how you found this topic.
Wow, it's a really good question. So my journey into academia, I think it's been quite a complicated one. And having listened to the other podcast you've done with other Coleman Prize winners, I think that seems to be a common theme amongst the winners, is that we all come into academia from slightly unusual paths. So in my case, I grew up on the outskirts of Ipswich in the United Kingdom, went to fairly normal state comprehensive schools, but I had some really wonderful teachers who inspired a love of history, which continues to this day. As an undergraduate at Cambridge, I was blessed to have the support of some excellent academics, in particular Mary Lavin and Helen Pfeiffer. Helen supervised me for my undergraduate dissertation on the English Levant Company and its operations in the Ottoman Empire in the early 17th century. And going to the archives for the first time, working with manuscript sources and developing my own argument, that was the point for me. That was the turning point where I thought to myself, this is what I want to do for my life, for my career. So after I completed my degree, I took a gap year. I came back to Ipswich and worked part-time in a school as a teacher assistant, and also started learning French, because I decided that having worked on English trade with the Ottoman Empire as an undergraduate, I wanted in my master's and PhD to work on French trade with the Ottoman Empire. It seemed like a good fit. So So while I was working, while I was learning French, I was putting in applications for PhD positions in America and a master's position at Cambridge in the UK. I was rejected for all of the PhD positions in America. And I did get an offer for the master's at Cambridge, but there was no funding attached to that. So in all honesty, I wouldn't have been able to have taken that up. And so come late that year, I thought the academic career, the academic dream was over, but fate intervened and a position was advertised on a European Research Council funded project run by Maria Fazzaro at Exeter, looking at maritime law in early modern Eurasia. And in particular for this position, Maria, who ended up becoming my supervisor, wanted this particular PhD project to look at marine insurance and marine insurance institutions in 17th century France. And a colleague of hers, Giovanni Ceccanoni, kindly identified some registers in the Archive National in Paris, which would be a good starting point. So when I saw this this advert, I just knew, at the moment I saw it, I knew that it was the right fit for me and I had to go for it. And although I didn't have a master's, Maria mercifully didn't mind and pushed very hard to give me that PhD position. And so I was awarded the position and the funding, and I moved to Exeter and started my PhD there. And after about half a year, I went to the archives in Paris for the first time. That was very challenging because it was the first time I'd worked in a French institution, first time I'd even worked with French archival sources. So it was a real dive into the unknown. It was a real single spin moment. And certainly for the first hour or so, I thought to myself, what have I done? Why am I here? Why did I think I could do this? But after carving down and spending some time with sources, I was eventually able to get to grips with it, and the rest of the PhD followed. And after I defended my thesis, after a long time applying for many positions and being rejected for many positions, which I appreciate is very common at the moment in the academic job market, I was fortunate enough to first of all get a postdoctoral position at the Institute of Historical Research as a fellow for the Economic History Society, and then my current position as a Murray Zosker Curie postdoctoral fellow at Leiden. So it's been a long meandering path, but here I am.
Thank you. Yes. Yeah, I think it makes the point that there is no straight line in terms of careers for many people, and just go with the flow in a way. But what did winning the Goleman Prize meant for you personally or professionally, given that this happened about 6 months from the time that we're talking, perhaps a little bit more? So what has this experience meant? How was the you know, running up to the presentation and the day, and since then how things have evolved for you?
It was a real privilege winning the Goleman Prize, and it came at a very important point in my professional career in terms of my sense of identity as a historian, because my dissertation and my book touches on a lot of different types of history. And certainly going through the PhD and then after the PhD, it was hard to position myself as a particular kind of historian. I could potentially suggest that I'm a social historian or a political historian or an economic historian, a business historian, and so on. So thinking about the type of historian I am and the type of historian I want to be, applying for the Goleman Prize really helped me with that, because at the time of applying, I wasn't sure if I would class myself as a business historian or whether I would be accepted as a business historian. Certainly, I've been reading lots of articles in the Business History Review, Enterprise and Society, and other articles and other journals. And certainly, I was greatly interested and greatly admired the work in those journals. But because of the nature of my research, I wasn't sure if I was quite the right fit for business history, whether I could really sell myself as one. So when I saw the advertisement for the call for the Coleman Prize, I wasn't expecting anything going in at all. I submitted my dissertation on the basis that it does no harm to try. So it was really heartening as the process went on, as I made it onto the long list, then the short list, and then came to the Association of Business Historians conference in Newcastle earlier in the year to present as part of the Coleman Prize session. It was, as I say, very heartening to feel like actually my research was a fit for the business history community and that I would be welcomed. And going into a room and presenting in front of a very large group of people, especially a group of people one hasn't necessarily engaged with before, engaging with that group for the first time is very nerve-wracking, and I wasn't sure what to expect, but I was very touched and very grateful to the audience for being so engaged with my presentation and for the really very sharp, very precise questions which they asked me, which showed that they had a very real interest in what I was saying. And so being announced as the Coleman Prize winner was a real honor. And now having the opportunity to work alongside members of the Association of Business Historians Committee it's allowing me to develop my professional ties further and develop those links with the business history community on a much surer footing than I would have done before. If beforehand I wasn't sure if I could say that I'm a business historian, now I am confident in saying that I am a business historian alongside being a historian of other things. It's okay to be navigating those different identities at once.
Taking moving things forward, making a parenthesis before we go into the book, what sort of advice would you give to other colleagues which are in a similar stage of development as you are, and in terms of about to finish or just finish their PhD, and then thinking about publishing this as a book or not, you know, the process of, because you've gone through a process of selecting a publisher, and then, as we said at the start of the recording, you secure funding for this publication to be open source, which adds another layer of complexity that not a lot of people might be aware or see the importance of that in the current climate of publication. So some people would go for, so what made you go for the book, and how did you manage this process is the question.
So my advice to people finishing up their PhD and thinking about their publication options, first and foremost, is to hang on in there to the extent that one can, of course, with the resources which you have at hand, because the academic job market is especially brutal right now. It is always brutal, but especially so at the moment. And while one is considering publication options, people will inevitably be applying for positions as well, postdoctoral positions, permanent positions, and they might find it takes a while for those applications to bear fruit. So so first of all, I'd assure people in that position that they're not alone, that it is very common for these things to take time. So you had your dissertation to hand, then you want to think about your publication options. I think the first thing to do is to talk to the people around you, ask your supervisors, ask other peers, other mentors you might have in your academic network and see what they recommend, because having engaged with your work, they will be in a good position to advise you as to how best to pitch your work, whether as potentially one or multiple articles, or as a book, or potentially a combination of the two. In my case, I felt it made sense, and my network around me felt it made sense to publish the thesis as a book, because the chapters tie together very closely. One chapter leads into the other to make this coherent narrative. So while it would have been possible to have taken the chapters and published them individually after some work, I feel in the case of the thesis and then the book, the whole is greater than the sum, its parts. And it made sense to put the effort into refining the chapters and then really honing in on the argument, rewriting and redrafting the introduction and the conclusion several times to get it to the point where I was happy with it. Because inevitably, at the time of submission of the thesis, it wasn't, it remained a work in progress. And so I was happy to be able to have the time after the submission, after defense, to be able to work on developing the book and making it, well, effectively making the thesis what I would have liked it to have been from the start, in effect. But equally for other people, the article approach might be more appropriate. And I did publish a few articles alongside the book, drawing on my doctoral thesis, one in Enterprise and Society, one in the English Historical Review, which took material which I would have liked to have put in the thesis, but unfortunately I couldn't quite make it. But it was a positive in the sense that I was able to take that material and instead turn this material into standalone articles, which has also been a big help to me in approaching the academic job market. So I think the situation is unique to everybody. Every person coming out of their PhD will have their own, will need to tailor their own approach to this. And as I say, the best thing that you can do, I think, is to think about what you think is best and ask the people around you and then work from there.
That is helpful. And it also opens up to move the discussion and ask you if you could give us at this point a big picture, concise overview of the book, while thinking, you know, what is it that you wanted to achieve, and we'll pan out or flash out, bring out some of the contributions that you make in the discussion after that.
Sure. So in effect, my book is a study of the marine insurance market in Paris under Louis XIV. So in particular, I study two marine insurance institutions established by Louis XIV. The first being the Royal Insurance Chamber, established in 1668, and then the Royal Insurance Company, established in 1686. And to the best of my knowledge, this company was the first chartered company in the history of marine insurance. So my book works, I would say, on two levels. On the one side, there is the comparative element. I wish to explore the nature of the Parisian marine insurance market and ask the broader question, well, why did Paris not emerge as a leading insurance center in the way in which London and Amsterdam, the leading markets in this period, and also the chief rivals to Paris, to France more broadly, England and the Netherlands, why did these markets achieve the levels of success which Paris did not? And the discussion of the book unfolds as a result of that broader research question. And in the process, pivoting to the other side of the discussion, I also want to understand or present a new presented your understanding of Aubergine France and how state intervention into the economy can give us a unique perspective on the nature of absolutism in this period.
So just to remind our viewers, you are talking about 17th and 18th century France. We're talking about the regime of Louis the 14th and the nature of politics, which you bring out into the narrative in a very interesting and subtle way, in which you're coming in and out, and where those the creation of these companies and the importance of maritime law or maritime insurance, sorry, is sitting within this discussion. One of the other things that you do is that you try to revise the discussion about Colbert and Colbertian policies, and to what extent it was really just these great tones of these policies. And in the process, you also give us a very interesting insight into the actual workings of mercantilism at this point in time, because it's a leading question. Why would French government officials or the king be interested in developing a maritime insurance market?
You say it's a leading question. I think it's an excellent question, actually. So in effect, marine insurance was one of the key markets which was driving for the development of Amsterdam as a major commercial center. And slowly but surely, London would rise as well to prominence on the back of, or at least with great support from its marine insurance market. Marine insurance and commerce more broadly go very nicely hand in hand because of the way in which the marine insurance market allows merchants to spread their risks. And the Amsterdam and London markets were able to do this on a level which other markets up to this point had not been able to do. And so it very much created this virtuous circle. And France looked on at the economic development of England, of the Netherlands, of London and Amsterdam with a great deal of envy and also frustration that France wasn't getting a slice of the action itself. As far as the French were concerned, first of all, Jean-Baptiste Colbert, Louis XIV's eminent minister of finance. Colbert was very frustrated because, as far as he was concerned, France was this incredible kingdom with this abundance of natural resources and incredible wealth. And yet somehow it was the Dutch who were ruling the seas, who had managed to establish this East India Company to create this colonial empire in the East Indies, with the English doing the same to a certain extent. And so Colbert wanted to put the Dutch in their place, in effect, and assert what he saw as France's natural supremacy in commerce. And so, first of all, in 1664 was the establishment of the French East India and West India Companies. But at the same time, he was also contemplating plans for a marine insurance company. This did not materialize, but the Royal Insurance Chamber followed in 1668. And the goal for this chamber was to link demand for capital in the ports of France with the supply in Paris, because Paris had a wonderful, deep well of capital, which simply needed to be tapped into. But there wasn't at this point in time necessarily a very developed capital market in Paris. The institutions and the institutional frameworks necessary for such a market were not yet in place. So the Royal Insurance Chamber was established and succeeded for a time in allowing merchants and ship owners in the ports of France, La Rochelle, Nantes, so on, to seek coverage and seek finance from wealthy Parisians. And as I said, it succeeded for a time. And equally with the establishment of the Royal Insurance Company in 1686, the goal was once again to get wealthy, well-connected investors on board to support the development of maritime France. And again, this was achieved with some success, but also with some challenges and some problems along the way. In the end, Paris was never able to achieve the sort of success which Amsterdam and London were able to do to achieve. And a large part of the book is explaining, well, why? Why is this the case?
And as you mentioned, it is a question of, on the one hand, how institutions and financial institutions in general, financial markets in particular, are built in the pre-industrial era, which is not something that happens easy, and it's something that we need to be reminded as people think that they have been there for ages. And in this sense, I think that, you tell me if it's fair, maritime insurance is pointing into an issue that becomes more prevalent during the Industrial Revolution, and that is the fact that individuals, family-run firms, no longer are able to assume the full risk of an enterprise. That assuming, buying a ship that is going to go around the world and coming back requires an amount of resources that goes beyond those that a single individual or a single family would have. Would that be fair?
I think there is a great deal of truth in that. And historians of marine insurance in the pre-modern and the modern period, there is often a lot of emphasis on Frank Knight's distinction between risk and uncertainty, which I think is quite useful to us as historians. This idea that either there is uncertainty, that which cannot be measured, that which cannot be quantified, that which cannot, a price tag cannot be put on, or risk, which is precisely the opposite, that which you can quantify and can therefore put a monetary value on. In the early modern period, a big issue, a big restriction on the development of maritime commerce is uncertainty. Is just not knowing what is going to happen and the inability to absorb capital shocks. When a ship is captured, when a ship sinks, these are things which can bring down an enterprise and with it entire chains of capital or of credit, indeed. And what a marine insurance allowed people to do, allowed merchants, allowed ship owners to do, was to put a price on that risk and to shift that risk to share it amongst the broader community so that such capital shocks weren't normally so problematic. But with the Industrial Revolution, of course, there's a great deal of complication that arises in economic affairs, increasingly sophisticated economic operations. And one just has to look today, insurance might not seem especially good fun or especially exciting to study, but it is everywhere. And it is the bedrock of the economy today. And as the effects of climate change ripple through the economy, and as particular risks potentially are converted back into states of uncertainty, as we as insurers look at particular situations and say, we can't put a price on this, or the price on this, if we can put a price on this, the price is so high that nobody would be willing to pay for it. It could potentially become a death by a thousand cuts as businesses find that all of these risks and uncertainties, which they were able to trade at a price up to now, suddenly they have to bear for themselves. And those capital shocks, which early modern people early modern merchants and ship owners had to deal with on a regular basis, suddenly that potentially becomes the norm again. And that would be an incredible shock to the system, to the economic system, and to our understanding, I think, of the world as we know it today.
And something that you give some bit of space, and I leave you to use the correct terminology, is whether the actions of the sovereign are going to be credible, and the importance of whether this the credibility of this action has in the creation of institutions. And you revisit this idea in the creation of these two markets. Would you kindly elaborate a little bit on this?
Certainly. So I was especially drawn to the argument of credible commitments following the publication of Ron Harris's book, Going the Distance, a few years back with Princeton University Press. So Harris's argument, which applies to the English and the Dutch East India companies, is that what the England is that what England and the Netherlands were able to offer to merchants, which other countries, including France, could not, was this credible commitment to not expropriate the resources of their subjects, in this case, merchants. To put it another way, those who invested in the English and the Dutch East India companies were, in Harris's argument, able to do so, confident that the money they invested was not going to be seized by the sovereign and used for other purposes. And for Harris, it's this distinction that explains why the English and Dutch East India companies arise so early in 1600 and 1602, so long before other countries established their own East India companies, and also why they achieved such a great deal of success where other companies, including the French East India Company, established by Colbert, did not. I'm not especially convinced by this argument. I find Harris's book fascinating, and there's a great deal I like about it. But this particular aspect of his argument, I find problematic, not least because credible commitment, I think, is not something which we see in England or the Netherlands, at least not on the level which he suggests, until far later in the day. And on the French side, credible commitment, I mean, theoretically on paper, it was a problem. Theoretically, Louis XIV was an absolute monarch whose power was unchecked by other institutions. But in reality, historians of France have been pushing back strongly against this perspective for many decades now. The consensus up until recent years has been one of absolutism as social collaboration, or in effect, that Louis XIV had to work with social elites to get done what he wanted to get done. He could not simply sit in Versailles and say, this is what I want, and you will do it. It was far more complicated than this. And so my book, in revisiting the argument on credible commitments, tries to reinterpret the chartered companies, including the French East India Company, but also the Royal Insurance Company, as I mentioned before, and tries to rethink these companies as breaches of absolutism, as ways for the state to get around the problem of credible commitment and still achieve what it wanted to achieve. In effect, investors knew going in that there was a very good chance that their investment would be expropriated in one way or another, but they still invested because of the social, legal, economic privileges often on offer to those who invested. So if we take a step back and not look at the companies purely as profit-driven endeavors, if we look at them as products of this broader culture of privilege, as broader creatures of absolutism, we get a very different picture, I suggest, of these companies and how they function, and why the fact that they didn't necessarily make profits isn't necessarily a sign of failure. Actually, in the case of the Royal Insurance Company, it as far as I can tell, based on the records which are still available to us, it looks like it lost all this money. But in fact, it was still regarded by ministers as successful because it was serving the function for which it was established. That is, it was designed, it was established with the express goal of protecting French commerce at sea. And in that sense, it had succeeded.
And that's one of the things that I very much like from your discussion, without making this a whole discussion of credible commitment and North and institutions, but certainly a little bit of a small criticism in this overemphasis into property rights as the drivers of long-term institutions and long-term development, which is probably at the heart of colleagues like Acemoglu, who's been very successful with their books. But you know, there's been some discussion on that. But let's move on. You use a wealth of archives, and you've already told us that it was the first time that you went to work with the French archives. So what other sources of material were you bringing together to tell this very rich story?
So the base for my research were the institutional registers for the chamber and the company. There is such a dearth of surviving evidence on marine insurance, even in the big markets in Amsterdam and London. So the registers which are in Paris for these institutions is quite extraordinary. And I was very lucky to be able to work with them and get so much out of them, especially since these registers are of such a diversity. There are the quantitative registers. So in effect, the policy registers themselves, listing the individual policies one after another, the amount underwritten, the voyages being insured, what was being insured, and who was doing the underwriting. And this allowed me to present a big macro picture of the two institutions and track their underwriting over time. And in the case of the chamber as well, the track record of individual underwriters. Also you have the more, what I would say are more qualitative registers as well. In particular, arbitration registers, which go into a lot of depth as to how conflicts emerged and how these were resolved. And I was able to pair the arbitration registers with the court records of the Parisian Admiralty Court to present a slightly different picture from the one which institutional economics often presents for conflict resolution. That is, in the case of 17th century Paris and for marine insurance, it wasn't simply a case of choosing arbitration over the court system because it was cheaper and so on. In fact, the two went hand in hand. Arbitration and litigation were mutually coherent. They were the mutually coherent strategies, and often arbitration was used as a first step, which would then be escalated to litigation if necessary, or even vice versa. And so this is a part of my analysis at the end of the book, which I really do try to bring out. Otherwise, another large part of my source base are the papers themselves, in particular the letters of the Secretariat of State for Maritime Affairs. These letters, which were being written from the Secretariat, both in terms of letters to individuals throughout France, throughout the world, seeking information which was useful for marine insurance purposes, but also memoirs discussing marine insurance. These papers really allowed me to dig to the heart of what we were discussing earlier about the state's interest in marine insurance. It was here that we really see why the state was interested and the lengths it went to support these institutions, because of course Paris is not a natural place to establish a marine insurance market. These institutions needed help, and they got a great deal of this support through the state and its information networks. And these state papers allowed me to track these information networks and how they were used in service to the needs of marine insurance.
You've told us a little bit about what is innovative, what is new in your work, and what have you questioned. You've told us a little bit about the sources that you've used. Well, what do you think is most distinctive, innovative, or borrowed from other disciplines or methodologies in your work?
What's most distinctive? Goodness, that's a very good question. I think the most distinctive element was pointed out to me actually in my viva for my thesis by my external examiner, Arnaud Morillet. He pointed out to me just how much my methodology and my way of approaching the topic was shaped, was being shaped by Braddell and his work. And while I've always been a big fan of Braddell and I've always brought his work into my own, I hadn't quite realized up until that moment just how important his way of understanding the world was to me as an historian. And so that, when I was writing the book, that was one of the main things I was doing, was bringing this distinctive Braddellian perspective into the core structure of the book, so that I could write this histoire totale, this total history, as Braddell calls it, which allowed me to bring together these social, political, economic, legal elements all together in a coherent narrative. So that looking at these underwriting portfolios of these institutions alongside legal practices, litigation, alongside even religious practices and religious solidarity, these elements all make sense because of the framework which I adopt thanks to Braddell. And I think that's probably what's the most distinctive thing about the book is that structure and the way in which it allows, I think, anybody with an interest in modern history and in all of these different disciplines, they will, I hope, find something in the book which will be at least of some interest to them.
Great. And what would be the interest of business people today from this research? You've talked a little bit about climate change. You've talked about insurance, but what would you expect business people to be drawn into reading your book?
So for business historians, I think the book is what I hope will be a good reminder of the importance of historical context in the nature of institutional development. It's very easy to apply and to bring anachronistic baggage with us when trying to approach questions about the past. And I did this myself in approaching the thesis and the book. My original question was to, my original desire was to understand, well, why did the Parisian insurance institutions fail where those of Amsterdam and Paris, and London, sorry, did not? And actually, that was a very, in posing the question in those terms, I was bringing a lot of baggage with me. I was looking at it from a very modern perspective, because as I was saying before, these institutions were not failures, at least not in a way which would be so easily described as failures. From a modern perspective of profit and profit maximization, we could say that these institutions were failures, but in fact, they were doing a lot more besides trying to make profits. So as I say, historical context, and I think that's one side which business historians will take. Also, the importance of the state in economic development. I appreciate that will be very unpopular with a lot of people who believe in the power of the individual in an individual enterprise. I don't wish to suggest that is incorrect, or that those perspectives should not be pursued. But I do stress the importance of the state in early modern economic development. And I think, coming back to the point you were saying before about climate change, the state is going to be once again a pivotal actor in economic development as we make that transition away from fossil fuels towards green technology. This is not something which the private sector alone, I would suggest, is able to do, as I say, by itself. It will need support. And there are, I think, real echoes across the ages. This common thread from the early modern period to the modern period in the role of the state in doing this, and also in responding to geopolitical tensions and competition as well. In the 17th century, it was France and England trying to push back against Dutch dominance in commerce and shipping. Today, it is the EU and the United States trying to push back against Chinese dominance in the procurement, the refining, and the utilization of the elements needed for the green transition. The state, whether we like it or not, matters. It mattered then, and it will matter again to us now.
And that ties very nicely to one of our previous podcasts on the varieties of capitalism and the role of the state and interaction between business and the state, which I will add to the show notes as well. Well, final question, if I may, which is, where are you working on now? What is your next big project?
So this is, I think, we come full circle, in fact. So I was mentioning at the start of the podcast that I was hoping originally to work on my master's and PhD on French trade with the Ottoman Empire. Fate intervened to bring me to real insurance, but now I'm finally returning to this original interest in France and the Ottoman Empire. So in particular, I'm looking at France's trade in woolen cloth with the Ottoman Empire. And this builds very nicely actually on my doctoral research, because the narrative which historians have presented to date comes in two parts for the most part. Firstly, the analysis tends to center on the interventions of Colbert, who was everywhere in the French economy in the 1660s and 70s up until his death in 1683. Colbert intervened in this industry to try and promote French trade with the Ottoman Empire. And then in the first half of the 18th century was the golden age of this industry and this trade with the Ottoman Empire. It was France's fastest growing industry and a real staple of the Mediterranean French economy. But how we get from Colbert's interventions to this golden age, I argue, actually hasn't really been explored. Colbert died in 1683, but the factories, the cloth factories he was supporting, were on the verge of bankruptcy, and trade with the Ottoman Empire remained fairly weak. The English remained the dominant players. And yet, within 17 years, by the turn of the 18th century, France was establishing itself as a major player alongside the English, and within a few decades would become the dominant player. So why? What happens in this intervening period to explain this rapid change of fortune? In exploring that, I seek to shift the perspective by looking in part not only on the Mediterranean perspective, that is France's trade with the Ottoman Empire, but also the trade of this cloth in Asia more broadly, in particular in India, in Siam, through the French East India Company. The investment of the French East India Company in this industry was very significant. And I see this as the forgotten part of the story. This investment helped to underpin the development of the industry through this pivotal turning point in the industry's history. And so looking at the industry from this Asian perspective rather than strictly Ottoman perspective, I seek to argue fills this gap and helps us to understand why the industry developed as it did. The project is at an early stage, and I am having great fun at the moment working through some archival material, and I look forward to being back in the archives in the coming months to continue the project further.
And we look forward to having you back in New Books Network when you have the publication out, because I'm sure it's going to make another riveting read. So, Luis Wade, thank you very much for being with us today, recipient of the Coleman Prize in 2023, and with the dissertation that is published now as Privileged Economy and State in All Regimes, France, Maritime Insurance, War, and the Atlantic Empire under Louis XIV by the Bodle Press, and as a paperback and open access book. The link to the open access book will be in the show notes. This was Bernardo Batis Lasso. Thank you for being with us. If you're a subscriber, please give us a comment or rank us. And if this is the first time that you listen to us, then do consider becoming a subscriber to New Books Network. Luis Wade, again, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners.